Mary O'Keefe is the woman you might see on building sites or at roadworks, staring downwards. She is a Wellington-based archaeologist who has been involved in many projects around the city. And if you look on our webpage, you'll see lots of photographs of the projects that she has been involved in. And she's with us now, Morena.
Morena, Kim.
Let's talk about the Plumbers Arc, first of all, because I mentioned that earlier. It's probably the thing that people know about if they're in Wellington at all. And it was discovered as a ship, as the name implies, underneath the old Bank Arcade in Wellington. A shipwreck in the middle of the city, right?
Exactly right.
How did you find out about that? What was the first thing you heard about that?
Look, I'm really glad you're starting with this one, Kim, because it is probably one of my most favourite projects ever. Because, as you say, it is a bit mad. Shipwrecks are normally out on the coast, and here we are in the middle of the city. So, really, there's lots of elements of Plumbers Arc and lots of aspects to the story, but one of the main aspects is pre-1855 earthquake Wellington, where the city and the shoreline was in a completely different place. So this little boat sitting on the corner of Willis Street and Lambton Quay was on the original shoreline. So it was sitting in the water. It was a little floating warehouse. And then after the earthquake uplift, it was high and dry. Long story short, they reclaimed all around it and the wee boat was buried. And some beautiful Bank of New Zealand buildings were built on top. Fast forward to 1996 when they were renovating the buildings to make a lovely shopping arcade. And as they punched through the floor of the building, lo and behold, here was bits of the boat. So my colleague was the principal archaeologist and she needed an extra pair of hands. So, gosh, I roared down like a mad thing, and we had the best time. So essentially every time we punched through more of a bit of floor of the BNZ complex, here was more bits of boat. So we were incredibly excited. The developer, maybe
not so much.
Not quite so much, although actually, bless them, they came to the party because anyone who now visits Wellington can go down to the basement of the BNZ and they can see that the bow, the front of the boat, is still sitting there under a glass floor. So it's a neat little story and also, as I say, in a sense, symbolising pre-earthquake Wellington, which you can't really see anywhere else. And that earthquake was such a massive event in Wellington. It just changed everything. Obviously, the physical landscape, but
and what do we know about that boat?
So it was built in Nova Scotia, and it was sailing around the world. It had just been to Adelaide. I beg your pardon, it was on its way to Adelaide and it was just coming into Wellington to stock up on its water. The Termsake users, it officially missed its course, which I think is boaty words for we really doffed the entry and smacked into the side of the harbour. So it was deemed to be a wreck and the owners in London said, ugh, get rid of it. So a likely lad in Wellington named John Plimmer purchased it, and his is a name that pops up all over the place of Plimmerton, the suburb, all of that. So he towed it into town and set it up as a floating warehouse. So that was in 1849, and it operated for a few years until the 1855 earthquake.
When you say a floating warehouse, you just mean a storage capacity?
No, so it was like a little shop.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so people were buying stuff. There was a customs house for a while, a bond house. So when people had imported stuff and they had to pay the government bond, it was stored in the boat for a while. So all sorts of functions.
And then the earthquake happened.
Yeah, and little boat fell over. But wasn't in the sea anymore because the sea had shot up by some 100 metres because of the coastal uplift. I mean, that was a stonking big earthquake.
I know.
Man, oh man, it would have been terrifying.
It was just terrifying just thinking about it, right?
Yeah. Apparently the water in Lambton Harbour slopped back and forth from Thorndon to Eastbourne for about 6 hours. You know, when you're in the bath and the water slops back and forth, just, doesn't bear thinking about.
No.
And fun fact, of course, that was the Wairarapa fault line, and that earthquake was 1855, and that fault line moves on average every 150 years. Do the maths, listeners.
I know, but what are we supposed to do with that maths?
I think we'll just have another gin and tonic and move on quickly.
You know, it's all very well to say, but what are we supposed to do? I mean, beyond having a... Well, emergency supplies.
That's the thing.
I mean, in places that are probably going to be inaccessible come the big one.
Yeah, just acknowledge that this is going to happen and flipping, don't pretend it's not.
No.
Yeah.
Generally, you mentioned the developer. Generally, do you find developers happy to help preserve what is found?
It's on a bit of a continuum. In the most general sense, yes, actually they are. So when I first started this archaeological gig about 25 years ago, so I should add, I'm a consultant. I'm a self-employed consultant. My vast company of one, which makes for a slightly lonely Christmas party, but there we are.
Most archaeologists in New Zealand are consultants, right?
Yes, they are. Yes, absolutely. So the vast bulk of us are doing this. And so the vast bulk of us are doing this development-driven work. So when someone is building a subdivision, a motorway, a wind farm, whatever it may be, we jump in and look at the archaeological.
Do you have a aspect. Right to jump in?
It's a legal requirement, yeah.
Under
the Heritage New Zealand Act,
right.
Which and it also has links to the Resource Management Act.
You've recently written the introduction of the Resource Management Act in 1991 was a game changer for archaeology.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you worried because now the RMA is set to go?
Not worried yet, because it's not as if it's disappearing. It's going to be replaced with something else. So I guess let's wait and see what it's replaced with. But even if the RMA does end up being some other magnificent beast, we still have the Heritage New Zealand Act, which legally protects archaeological sites. And it's really powerful. And actually, it's one of the most powerful bits of heritage legislation in the world. But certainly what you were saying before about developers... Back in the day when I first started this gig, people would sort of think, oh, God, archaeology, pain in the ass, let's ignore it until we last possible second. Now, I think developers have found out the hard and chunky and expensive way that actually doing that really doesn't work, comes back to bite them on the tushy. So we archaeologists often get involved right at the beginning of a project. So even before any machines touch the ground in planning the project. So then archaeology just becomes beautifully entwined in the whole project. Everyone knows what the go is. We jump in and do our bit. When it's really well planned, we don't hold things up at all. We truly don't. I can put a hand on heart and say that, because we've sequenced and planned it, and we just work with the guys and gals on the machines, and away we go.
There's a photo on our webpage actually that people can have a look at of you standing. This must be the Kapiti Expressway, is it?
A lot of those photos are the Kapiti Expressway, which was a career highlight, can I say.
Fabulous fun.
Oh my God, it was fun.
You were standing in front of a digger peering down.
Yes.
I mean, a digger is not a delicate instrument.
Well, I think that's one of the lovely things. When people think of the word archaeology, often, well, Indiana Jones
tweezers.
To one side, but yes, very much Discovery Channel, camel hair brushes, beautiful little square trenches. You're there for weeks doing minute work. Most of our work as consultant archaeologists isn't that we're working with the guys and gals on the 40-ton diggers, as you see in that photo. So sometimes we do get an opportunity to look at a site in a bit more detail, but very often it is that kind of work. So it's almost a trade-off. The developer legally has the right to build their motorway, subdivision, whatever, but in exchange we get to scientifically extract the information out of the ground.
And what did you find on the expressway in the process? I know human remains were unearthed along the way, weren't they?
Yeah, they were, but that's not unusual.
No.
Koi, we turn up all over the place.
Were you able to find out? I tell you what, just push that chair back because it's bumping against the microphone.
There we go.
I've been trying a forensic examination of the studio to find out where that was coming from, and I found it.
There we go.
Human remains, no, I'm sure not unusual.
Yeah.
What happens? I mean, that must hold up construction for a while.
Yes, that actually does. And everyone's pretty respectful about that, because everyone understands you have to have a particular process around that. That's not a normal kind of archaeological site. So as archaeologists, we're nearly always working with iwi anyway. We have iwi monitors with us the whole time. But certainly for kuiwi, for human remains, pretty much stuff does stop around that part of the project, and we all work out what are we going to do. Most times, because the burials have turned up in the middle of some sort of development, they do have to be excavated. They can't be left in the middle of a six-lane expressway.
No.
But it's around how they're excavated, what analysis may be done, because obviously lots and lots of information on health and well-being and all sorts of things that bones can tell us, wonderful, wonderful stories. But needless to say, there's the sensitivity of this to the local iwi, because these are not scientific elements to them. These are, they're tūpuna. These are, you know, someone's mum, someone's nana.
So yeah. There's a limit to how much you can examine them.
Yeah, yeah. So
were they examined?
The ones on the Kapiti Coast?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
And what did we find out?
So we found out, so there was one particular burial. She was a woman. She was an adult in fairly good health. And there was nothing else particularly unusual or notable about her.
How old were the bones?
So probably 1700s or 1800s, not particularly old. She was certainly Māori, and you can tell that straight away by looking at the skull and the jaw. So Polynesian morphology is completely different to European morphology. And then she was just reinterred in a urupa, actually right beside the expressway, so...
And why was it such fun working on the expressway for you?
Two things, I think. One, because it was a really big scale project. So I've done lots and lots of little bits of work up on the Kapiti Coast, but it's like tiny little dots here and there. Whereas this expressway, I kind of facetiously referred to it as an 18-kilometre long archaeological test trench, because it kind of was. So I got to have a look at all of the sites that turned up. So it was really around getting the big picture. So it was no one site or one element. It was the big picture of the collective, what it all means. Mm. So where were the sites? And then just as importantly, where weren't they? What kinds of sites? And again, the absence of data, what kinds of sites didn't we find? So putting all of this together. And so for the first time, we were able to do a regional story, if you like, of the archaeology of the Kapiti Coast. And we didn't have that before. And we've had it for most regions around New Zealand, but Kapiti was one where we were lacking it. So, yeah, we now have sort of the big story. But
get back to the big story for me in a moment. Yes.
The other thing that was really fun on this particular job was working with the guys and gals on the machines, on the excavators, because these people are so skilled. Man, they're skilled. As you can see in the picture with me staring vacantly at a machine with its bucket. But you draw a line in the sand and you say to your digger driver, can you bring your bucket down just there and can you please scrape off 3 centimetres for me? And they do. This is a 40-tonne digger and the bucket alone weighs, you know, nearly a tonne. So rather than me taking 4 hours or something to do it by hand, they do it in 10 minutes.
Yeah, I do note that. One of the photos is of a finger. Is it your finger? Mm.
That's my fat, pudgy little finger.
Holding a fish vertebrae.
Yes.
Which is part of a sample from the Mackayster Pekka Pekka Expressway, right? Well, you're not going to find that after the earth's been scooped up by a 30-ton digger.
No, you're not. No, that's right. So there's all sorts of different strategies we use for whatever the landscape is, whatever the site is, whatever we're needing to do. So quite often we do hoik out by hand jolly big samples into plastic bags. So that fish bone was part of a big shell midden. So that's basically a rubbish deposit. But you can tell heaps about people and what they're doing by what they throw away.
But we knew that they would inevitably have eaten fish.
Yeah, we do. But it's then drilling down a little bit more. So with those middens, it's kind of, okay, what kind of species are in there? What kind of proportions? So what kind of shellfish? What kind of fish?
Do you know what kind of fish?
Yeah, absolutely.
What was it?
Oh, my goodness, all sorts of things. So basically people were clearly throwing nets just off the beach, and people were also doing deeper sea fishing, so taking a walker out. But the interesting thing with a lot of this stuff is that a phrase I often use, small things tell big stories. And I think my finger with that tiny little fishbone is a really good example. So with that, we're able to get an understanding of, say, 400 or 500 years ago, these are the kinds of species that were on the Kapiti Coast in this kind of proportion and all of these kinds of things. You can then have a look at that stuff today and see, how does it compare with the environment today? Mm. Is it the same sort of species in the same sort of proportions? So that leads directly into kind of climate change, environmental change. So topics that are really front and centre, these tiny little things can absolutely contribute significant parts of that story.
You've said, and I'm referring again to the paper that you wrote for Archaeology in New Zealand just earlier this year, that consultants' work, archaeological consultants' work, is largely reactive.
Yes.
Responding to the client's proposals, and consequently, it's commercial.
Yes.
Now, this is a problem?
Not really.
Have pointed out, because of the commercial nature of their work, consultants have to focus more on getting enough work and less on results.
That's almost oversimplifying it.
I'm quoting you.
Well, I was oversimplifying it, then I'll put my hand up to that one. So the particular issue there is that there is relatively little research-driven archaeology happening in New Zealand. So most of it, as I note in that paper, is reactive. So we don't get to choose where a client builds their subdivision or builds their motorway or whatever. We just have to respond to that work. So certainly one of the points I make in that paper is that we have loads of research questions, really important research questions that we're not necessarily able to answer. But with the work we do, we can focus research strategies around that. So we're not just digging up stuff just for the hell of it. We're actually asking questions around it. We're really asking the question, what is the site or what can the site tell us that we didn't already know? And sometimes it's not very much and sometimes it's huge amounts, but it's kind of your don't know until
you never
start.
Know.
Yeah. Until you start looking.
What's the most exciting thing, apart from the Kaupiti Expressway, possibly, that you've worked on ever?
Oh, see, people always ask me that
I
question.
Know.
Can I do the top 20?
Yeah.
No, well, we haven't got an hour and a half, have we?
No.
So, in fact, it probably would be the two that we've already touched on. So,
Plymouth Arc
and the Expressway. But I'm incredibly lucky because I've got to work all sorts of places around the country and looked at all sorts of things. I worked in the Bay of Plenty about a bazillion years ago. I dived in Lake Waikaremoana looking at a teeny wee shipwreck in there.
Are you a scuba diver?
I am a scuba diver.
And is that why you took up scuba diving, to look at wrecks and things?
Not really. It was more just a happy coincidence. So I really should make it clear I'm not a trained maritime archaeologist. I'm simply an archaeologist who knows how to dive. And for an awfully long time...
Well, you were the president of the Maritime Archaeological Association of New Zealand.
Yes, yes.
That's, you know... Yes. Quite impressive.
But that's an advocacy group, not a professional group.
All right.
For an awfully long time, I was the only game in town in New Zealand because we didn't have any maritime archaeologists, so it was sort of me or nothing. but now I have some fantastic colleagues, Matt Carter and Coop Bennett, and all sorts of people who are doing just great work. So I just sit in my armchair and think longingly of if I was 170 years younger, you know,
apart from being able to scuba dive, what special skills do you need to be a marine archaeologist?
It's much like being a terrestrial archaeologist, actually. It's really thinking about the site you're working on, what its context is, and how to best extract the information. But especially with maritime sites, you often only get one crack at it. As in, once you've sort of buggered up the bottom of the seabed, you don't really get to go back and have another go, so you have to plan your strategy really well.
Why is that different from terrestrial archaeological
sites? So with terrestrial archaeology, same principle applies in general of once you've trashed that site, it's gone. But perhaps because you have got a visually broader view, you can see your entire site. What I mean by that is with maritime archaeology, if your visibility is really limited, if you can only see maybe half a metre in any one direction, you can only see this very small area immediately in front of you. And so you can't necessarily see how far your site may extend behind you, beside you. Yeah, kind of different physical strategy.
Yep. Does lots of wrecks, obviously, off New Zealand, is that the main thing that's being investigated with marine archaeology?
Wrecks, yes, but I think that whole interface of the coast of New Zealand is really fascinating. So where the land meets the sea, and we're an island nation, stating the obvious, but... As an island nation, our maritime archaeology is so important. So obviously for an awfully long time, everyone who came to New Zealand arrived by sea. So whether that was the first Polynesians in Waka, whether it was Europeans in government-assisted trips, whatever it was. So that whole interface of where did people arrive? Why did they choose the bits they chose? What did they do when they first got here? There's some fabulous stories to be told there. And we haven't really unpicked that research yet, so still lots to be done. Good fun.
What would you, if you would choose one area of New Zealand to explore further, other than where you are now, where would it be?
The coast.
Anywhere.
The coast of New Zealand, because I think essentially the coast of New Zealand, it feeds into the story of the Polynesians and Polynesian voyaging and settlement and discovery of the Pacific. And when you think of the Pacific Ocean and all the tiny little passes of land in it, that's a area that is about a third of the planet. And of course, the Polynesians found and inhabited pretty much every inhabitable piece of land there. I mean, it's the most just jaw-droppingly cracking good story of humanity. And New Zealand is obviously part of that. So that whole story of people moving around this enormous continent that happens to be made of water.
A text came in, says, Mary O'Keefe said 1855 uplift 100 metres.
Oh,
did you say that?
No.
I didn't think you said that.
No. The uplift was...
It's centimetres.
100 metres, mind
you. You may have said 100 metres.
No, I don't think so.
I heard you as centimetres, and that would be
more realistic. No, so the uplift was realistic. About, between 2 and 3 metres. So it was an angled uplift.
Right.
I'm sorry, listeners, I'm sitting here waving my arms and we're on the radio. But
I do that constantly, don't you, Wayne?
But centre in Wairarapa, so basically the further west you got from Wairarapa, the higher the uplift, if you like. So it's like a lever. Right. Certainly not 100 metres, my goodness.
Yep. And magnitude, somebody says magnitude 8.4.
Estimated, yes.
Published by Victoria University Press, stated the Wairarapa Fault moves once every 500 years.
Oh, okay.
Give or take 350.
Okay. So
that's ridiculous, isn't it?
But
very exact, he goes on to say, but we are not so much due for another big one as entering, this is splitting hairs, Chris, if you don't mind me saying so, but entering the period where the likelihood of the next big one exists and will over time increase.
So that's basically living in Wellington. Assume there's going to be an earthquake. Yeah. Get ready.
No, yeah. Quite right.
Yeah.
Lots of shipwrecks we talk about. Lots of the liminal area, the coast, the land, sea, zone.
Mm.
But does water, seawater, does that preserve things or damage them?
So it can preserve them. So certainly with shipwrecks, if there is a waterlogged object, actually same with freshwater, for a waterlogged object, leaving it there in the first instance is the best thing to do, because the water absorbs into the cells of the wood and holds them steady.
Yes.
Yeah, so once you take something out of the water, it's
you have
all,
to pump
it's
it
almost,
full of something else.
It's
right?
Like, our lady faces and our cells collapsing. You need to apply.
Not only our lady faces.
Yeah, well, let's
all
not
our
go
faces.
There.
You know, men collapse as well.
Well, quite so, except we're the target market, aren't we, with all the expensive face cream. So face cream for shipwrecks, essentially.
Yes.
Once you take it out of the water, you need to keep it in a wet state, or pump it full of chemicals to maintain the stability of the wood cells, which is eye-wateringly expensive.
There's a picture of you diving on our webpage. You're diving at Mahanga Bay.
Mm.
What are you looking at?
So that's here in Wellington, and that is a little wharf. It's a pile of a wharf that was associated with a military site around the Miramar Peninsula. So Wellington, like many parts of New Zealand, we experienced the Russian scare. So when Russia had a big, big, big navy and based in Vladivostok. And,
this is when? 19th century?
19th century, late 19th century.
Right.
And Australia and New Zealand, we all got this idea that the Russians were going to roar down the Pacific and take us over. So lots of defences around the coast of New Zealand and Australia actually date from this Russian scare period. They were then rebuilt for First and Second World Wars.
I don't think I ever knew that.
Mm, it's a fantastic story. Again, storytelling. Great story. Yeah. So lots of our coastal defences are actually really, really old. They've just been repurposed. So that little wharf was a torpedo wharf. So they had little torpedo boats, which was basically a boat with a little torpedo stuck right out the front. So you'd rush up to a boat, ram it, almost set the timer, detach your torpedo, and then rush away really quickly. Hopefully you got away in time.
We had those.
We had those. Yeah.
Tied up at this wharf.
Yes. Another really famous wharf that colleagues excavated.
Were they ever tested,
down
these
in Christchurch?
Yes.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, in New Zealand, I'm not sure, but certainly elsewhere around the world, they were quite effective technology at the time. You know, we laugh now, but they did the trick.
Huh.
Yeah.
There's another photo of you examining wallpaper.
Yeah.
I'm imagining that there's some kind of old newspaper behind there?
That one there wasn't, but quite often we do find newspaper, absolutely.
What can you tell from that old wallpaper?
So, again, it's really the storytelling. So it's almost the social use of spaces and houses. So the glorious thing is in the public rooms that your visitors are going to see, you would have very expensive flash wallpaper. In your private bedroom, which no one but you sees, cheap as chips, absolutely spit through it. And so much like, say, furnishings of today, it is all about social status of what you want to project to your visitors. And we see this with wallpaper in the 19th century.
Is there anything that you think people 100 or 200 years hence will discover about you? And see, we're so documented. Do you think we will ever need in the future for us the kind of work you're doing now backwards, if you see what I mean?
I do see what you mean, and it's a question that I often mull on. So we are really, really documented, I agree, but I think there is
also... Because we don't shut up about ourselves. I mean, that's it, isn't it?
Yeah, Twitter, exactly. We're all over the
whether
internet.
That will last or not, I don't know.
But something will come in to replace it, presumably. Right. But I think there is also, though, something about the physical evidence of events, of people, of activities that the documentation can't quite capture. So to be able to hold the object in your hand or see the physical extent of the site, you can't replicate that in a documented source.
Mm. Somebody says, do you share the frustration, you've got 30 seconds, of amateur wreck divers that not enough use of the expertise of amateurs is made to document shipwreck sites while they last?
Short answer, yes, because those amateurs often tear the site apart. And so the ability to tell the story is, it's like you've just ripped two chapters out of the book.
Yeah.
You can't tell a story.
No, that must be very frustrating. Mm. Thank you. Very nice to talk to you. Mary O'Keefe, a consultant archaeologist. Bill Bailey will be on the programme next week. Neil Finn will be in our Auckland studio. And polar photographer Max Quinn. Also Anjun Moon, the Australian director of I Am Woman, a biopic about the late Helen Reddy.